Evergreen Sermons Online in Pastor Michael Gabbert's Wednesday night series, Ephesians Strategic Living. This message is from April 3rd, 2019.
Good evening. Oh, that was good. That was good. Appreciate you being here. Appreciate you being here. We are deep into a study of the book of Ephesians, and we have left the real theological foundations behind us, and we're into the practical explanations of how you do this thing that we say we believe. Years ago, I was pastor of my first church was called First Baptist Church in Throckmorton, Texas. And near Abilene. About half the people in Throckmorton took the Abilene newspaper and went to the Abilene Hospital, and about half the people took the Wichita Falls newspaper and went to the Wichita Falls Hospital. So I got to go in both directions all the time. But we took the Wichita Falls newspaper, and there was an article one time that I saved that I've thought about over the years. It was about a man who had years before in his, maybe in his 30s, he had been in a car accident, and he spent about 3 months in a coma following the car accident. He eventually kind of emerged from the coma, but he quickly slipped into what they call a vegetative state. And he was in a vegetative state for years. But what they discovered was he had some decay in a tooth, and so in his vegetative state, the doctors prescribed some dental work, and so they wheeled him, you know, into the examination room and gave him some Valium to relax the body so the doctor could do the dental work. And he woke up. And it was a medical phenomenon because they gave him Valium and he woke up. He woke up, he talked, he walked, they gave him some complicated math problems and he was able to do math. I mean, you know, those things that your teacher said that you would use in life that you never did. Well, apparently if you come out of a coma, that's what they give you to do. He did math problems. And when the Valium wore off, sure enough, he slipped into a vegetative state. And they, the family, periodically would have the doctors administer Valium. He'd wake up for the day, join the family for some event, and then he'd go back to sleep. I thought about that this afternoon because at the point where we are in the book of Ephesians, Paul is going to talk about the Christian life in terms of waking up and staying awake. And I thought about that article because, frankly, waking up is something that we pretty much take for granted. I mean, you go to sleep and you wake up. We don't even think about it. We don't open our eyes and go, oh, I woke up today. It's just a normal routine. We take it for granted. We assume that it's going to happen. But if you're a guy that doesn't normally wake up, waking up would be quite the event. Paul's going to talk about the Christian life in terms of waking up, but I think he means for us to recognize what an extraordinary thing it is for sinners to encounter the living God and find ourselves awake, aware of the way the world operates, having an idea of what's right and what's wrong and how to live this life and how to experience the presence of God. He's going to tell us, wake up, and once you're awake, unlike the guy with the Valium, once you're awake, stay awake. The old term that they used to use when I was a kid was backsliding. You know, Paul, I think, would use different language. I think he would talk about backsliding in terms of slipping into a nap or dozing. Because he's gonna tell us that once you're awake, once your spirit is alive, there's a certain kind of life that flows out of that, and do that life on purpose. We finished last week with the first two verses of chapter 5. My wife gave me a gentle or not so gentle rebuke that I skipped verse 32 of chapter 4. She said, you didn't even read it. So she's sitting right there. I'm going to read this verse, okay? Last verse of chapter 32. And be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving one another, just as God also forgave you in Christ. That is Paul's summary of the life that he's been describing. You know, he talked about the things that you're not supposed to do. We looked at that last week. And then he talks about the things that he wants you to do. Putting away things. Don't grieve God's spirit. But this is his summary verse. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving one another, just as God also forgave you in Christ. The point of the verse is simply a reminder that the motivation for this life that we're called to, you know, maybe your mama told you be nice to people because that's what nice people do. The Bible is very clear. We act a certain way because God in Christ acted that way toward us. We've received mercy, so we show mercy. We've experienced forgiveness, so we're to be free with forgiveness. We know what it means to have a God who weeps with us in compassion during our grief, so we're to be a people who know how to weep with other people in compassion during their grief. It's a reminder of, it's a summary verse that reminds us of what a Christ-like life looks like. Now, he goes there and says, because of all these things, therefore be imitators of God as dearly loved children. We talked about that, verses 1 and 2. So we're going to pick up with verse 3. And Paul is going to give us, beginning in verse 3, a detailed explanation and instruction for carrying out verse 1. He says, be imitators of God. Well, let me tell you how to do that. And this week I actually remembered to get an outline. It's right here. How do we do that? Well, we understand the difference between light and dark. And he's going to start by saying you reject the lifestyle of darkness. That's what authentic followers of Jesus do. So let's look, first of all, at verses 3 through 7. And I want to show you the sin to be avoided and then the explanation for why we put away sin. That's a legitimate question. And Paul, in his day, faced a particular school of thought. There were several branches of Gnosticism in the first century. And one of the branches had this weird idea that the soul and the body are not really connected. In fact, the body is simply a housing container for the soul. But what happens to the body doesn't affect the soul. The soul is just temporarily housed there, warehoused there. And so in this school of thought, what you did with your body, the lifestyle of sexual immorality or substance abuse or anything like that, it didn't really affect your soul, the essence of who you were, because it was just your body, and your body's just material. It's not eternal, it's not significant, it doesn't matter. And so Paul is gonna take that head on, and he's gonna say, let me talk to you about some things to avoid, but this list tends to be those kinds of things that the Gnostics would have said, oh, that doesn't matter. Go ahead. That doesn't matter. And Paul's going to not only say, don't do these things, but he's going to give us an explanation. And I think he's talking to that group of people, but it pops up occasionally, even in our generation. Well, why can't I do that? Sometimes we come before God and we sound just like, you know, the toddler, you know, don't touch that burner on the stove. Why not? Because it's hot. I mean, we almost, It is inbred in us to not accept authority. So the question is, why? Why can't I? Why is, well, give me an explanation. Teenagers are the worst. Well, why can't I do that? Well, did your mom say what my mom used to say? Because I said so. Okay, that's how I grew up. But Paul's going to actually give us an explanation and walk us through that. So let's look at these verses. Chapter 5, verse 3. He says, but sexual immorality and any impurity or greed should not even be heard of among you as is proper for saints. Coarse and foolish talking or crude joking are not suitable, but rather giving thanks. For know and recognize this. Every sexually immoral or impure or greedy person who is an idolater does not have an inheritance in the kingdom of the Messiah and of God. Let no one deceive you with empty arguments, for God's wrath is coming on the disobedient because of these things. Therefore, do not become their partners. All right, let's talk about that. Sins to be avoided. He says, I want these things that I'm going to mention to you, I want them to be so foreign to you as followers of Jesus that there's not even the slightest suspicion of these things or that they can even occur. Paul's idea is we're meant to live such a life that if we were accused of one of these sins, the response would be, oh no, that can't be. I know that person. We're to live such a life that an accusation of sexual immorality, that an accusation of crude behavior in any way would be met with skepticism. No. We live in a culture, unfortunately, that is all too quick to jump on the bandwagon without proof. Oh, did you hear about so-and-so? I heard. Well, that's called gossip and that's a sin. But Paul said the appropriate response is to live together in community in such a way that we experience intimacy within the body of Christ, an intimacy that means we know each other well enough that if somebody says, well, I heard this, we go, no, we always give each other the benefit of the doubt because we know each other's lives well enough to know that doesn't sound like that person. He wants us to live so that we don't even have the slightest suspicion of this kind of behavior. Now he starts by saying, by lumping two groups together, he says, sexual immorality and any impurity or greed should not be heard of among you as is proper for saints. Immorality, impurity, and greed. These are all words that relate to any kind of sexual perversion, promiscuous behavior, that is, a sexual activity outside the biblical boundaries that is acceptable to God. It includes pornography, even in private. I had somebody tell me to my face one time, yes, I view pornography, but never around anybody else. Oh, well, there you go. No, it includes that language. It also, the word greed is really, it really is the word self-indulgence. We think about greed as a grasping for more. What Paul means here, and I think it has kind of a physical and sexual implication because he groups it with sexual immorality and impurity. It's translated greed, but I really think self-indulgence is better. Now for us, we use that language, self-indulgence. You know, if you have, a piece of chocolate, we go, oh, I'm just indulging myself. That's not what this is talking about. Okay. There may be a situation somewhere, but probably eating a piece of chocolate would not be considered sinful. Paul is specifically talking about behavior. We could translate it this way. Instead of self-indulgent, maybe we could translate it sexual immorality, impurity, and unhealthy appetites. Anything that we begin to yearn for, any kind of addictive behavior that begins to take on a life of its own, that's what he's talking about here. Don't be characterized by these kinds of perversions. Now he has a second group. He says those things shouldn't even be heard among you. But then he says, coarse and foolish talking or crude joking are not suitable, but rather giving thanks. Now, this sounds odd to us because our culture has become so coarse, so impolite and uncivil in its discourse that we say, oh yeah, sexual immorality and perversion and impurity and unhealthy appetites. I mean, I get that. That still makes sense to me. But this other part, coarse and foolish talking or crude joking, I mean, what's the big deal about that? We consider those to be, you know, respectable sins. You know, telling a joke here or there, using a language, some language that, you know, helps us fit in with the boys. The Greek word means filthy narrative, filthy stories, ungodly talk, gossip. And here's this phrase, crude joking. In our minds, crude joking is usually inappropriate jokes that have kind of sexual innuendo. But really, what Paul's talking about here, and this helps me understand it quite a bit. The Greek word here that's translated crude joking really means making light of sacred things. Think about it this way. A priest, a rabbi, and a duck walk up to the gates of hell. You know, I mean, those kinds of jokes that we say, oh, that's harmless, that's so funny. Listen, when you understand the reality of hell, I mean, nobody has a better sense of humor than followers of Jesus. I read a book years ago called The Laughter of Jesus, and it talks about, it interprets the stories of Jesus, you know, the idea of a camel passing through the eye of a needle. I mean, Jesus said a lot of things that I think he said with a twinkle in his eye, and everybody giggled when he said them. I think Jesus was a funny guy. I think he did that on purpose. That's part of why people like to be around him. But Jesus never joked about deadly serious business. Hell was not a funny topic. He didn't crack wise about, you know, St. Peter at the gates of the, at the pearly gates. There are some things that have eternal consequences, and those are not really proper for this sort of lighthearted, you know, I think Satan is pretty tricky at this point. If we can tell jokes about hell and kind of make it a lighthearted, you know, humorous topic, does that not put, it's like putting a label that says peppermint over a bottle that's filled with rat poison. You know, we kind of make it, you know, easy to be around, easy to handle. To hear the word hell spoken out loud ought to send chills down people's spines. Now, Paul and Jesus, they don't want us to sit around and not have a sense of humor. I mean, they want us to enjoy life. God meant for us to do. But here he's talking about people that make light of things that really are not meant for such an approach. Let's see, where was I? Oh. Coarse and foolish talking or crude joking are not suitable, but rather give thanks. Why would he say that? You know, gratitude is the number one character trait for Christians listed in the New Testament. I mean, if you just total up the number of times every character trait is listed, gratitude far outpaces everything else. I think Paul would say it is absolutely impossible to live a growing, effective Christian life without a grateful spirit. Whether it's about counting your blessings one by one or simply daily trying to recognize all that God is doing in your life that you have to be thankful for, he says, instead of making light of sacred things, how about if we show gratitude for those sacred things? I think this is Paul's describing practical ways that we're to live this life of being imitators of God. Jesus, as I've said, I think had a great sense of humor, but he never was lighthearted about weighty topics. He says, for you know and recognize this, Every sexually immoral or impure or greedy person who is an idolater does not have an inheritance in the kingdom of the Messiah and of God. Here's where he begins this conversation about the reasons why we should avoid sin. He just takes the first three sins that he's mentioned, sexual immorality, impurity, and greed, and he turns them into nouns, and he talks about sexually immoral or impure or greedy people. He says, if you're characterized by these sins, you're an idolater, and you don't have an inheritance in the kingdom of the Messiah and of God. Now, let me spend just a minute with this verse, because American Christians have a real bad habit of parsing words down to the nth degree when we're trying to find loopholes. Years ago, in another place, I had somebody come to me, and we were having a conversation about sexual purity, and he said, and he pointed to this verse, and basically he highlighted a phrase, and he said, every sexually immoral or impure or greedy person who is an idolater. Now, I'm not an idolater, so this verse doesn't apply to me. Oh, my stars. Some people just make me tired. Let me tell you what Paul, let's go back to Greek. What Paul is saying is, he's not saying any person who displays these characteristics and happens to also be an idolater is not okay with God. What he's saying is, anybody who lives a life that is marked habitually by these kinds of sins is an idolater by definition, because those sins have become the God they worship. You see what I'm saying? A sexually immoral person, a person who pursues promiscuity, who utilizes pornography, who makes this a daily habit. Now, you say, well, you know, let's parse it. I mean, define daily habit. Oh my goodness. Just leave it at this. If you spend more time thinking about how you can plan, organize, and get away with sin than you do thinking about how you can plan, organize, and imitate Jesus, you are an idolater. Paul says people who have set their minds on things below, they pursue them, they think about them, they strategize them, they nurse the ideas, they live for those things. That is the biblical definition of idolatry. The pursuit of any object, any behavior, any practice that replaces the pursuit of Jesus in the normal traffic patterns of your life. I would suggest that it is possible to be an idolater about sexual things and never be actually physically unfaithful to your marriage. Well, that's a little strict. Well, let's go to First Timothy, where Paul is going to give qualifications for elders and deacons. First Timothy chapter 3. He has an interesting phrase that has been misunderstood for so many years. He says one of the qualifications for a pastor, an elder, or a deacon is that they're to be a husband of one wife. Now, traditionally, at least in Southern Baptist history, that phrase has been interpreted to mean he's never been divorced. And so we for decades made divorce kind of the unforgivable sin, and you couldn't be in church leadership, and you couldn't pastor, and you couldn't be a deacon if you were divorced. That's not what that passage means. Okay? Think about it this way. When you read 1 Timothy chapter 3, what you see is that Paul gives us a long list of character traits or qualities. Boom, 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 boom. And then he says, and a husband of one wife, which in the traditional interpretation is not a character quality, it's a marital status. But in the context of the chapter, Paul's talking about the character of church leaders, the character of elders, the character of deacons, And it's incongruent that he would then all of a sudden randomly stick in a social status when he's talking about character. Well, when you go back and you study what Paul means by this phrase, a husband of one wife, he means a husband preoccupied, enamored, captured by his wife. In other words, we might translate it as a one-woman man. Well, see, now we're talking about a character quality. Because Paul is describing a man who is so devoted to a single woman that she is all he sees when he, you know, when he looks out on the world. She has captured his imagination. Okay? That's what Paul means when we come back over here to Ephesians, when he says, anybody that's sexually immoral or greedy, or, you know, they give themselves to unhealthy appetites, they are an idolater. Because that has captured their mind. This phrase, husband of one wife, Paul wants us to understand the Christian model within marriage is that you are so captivated mentally and emotionally with your spouse that you don't have eyes for anybody else. A pastor should not be flirtatious. A deacon should not be going out of his way to look at other women. See, that's what Paul's describing. He's not describing marital status. He's describing a character quality. That's what Paul is doing here in Ephesians. So this is not a verse where we go, well, you know, does that really apply to me or not? The basic understanding of verse 5 is, if you give your time and energy, if your imagination is captured by these things that don't belong in the life of a saint, you're an idolater. You have you have the wrong God on your throne. Well, what's the consequence of that? You do not have an inheritance in the kingdom of the Messiah and of God. Now, this is where Christians get all bent out of shape because, so, am I a Christian or am I not a Christian? Well, remember what I said. These are habitual sins that have come to characterize your thought life and your behavior. Martin Luther used to say that it is not a sin to be tempted by sin. Temptation is like a bird that flies over your head. He would say it's not a temptation for the bird to fly over your head. It is a sin if you let that bird nest in your hair. It is not a sin to be tempted by sin. It is a sin to snuggle up close to temptation and nurture it and think about it and dream of it and plan it out and desire it. That's what Paul's talking about here. So the inventory comes to the place. Remember, he's talking to people who've said, you know, it doesn't matter what you do with your body. Do whatever you want to. That doesn't touch your soul. Your soul is separate. It's the essence of who you are. The body is insignificant. Paul is directly contradicting that. He's saying when the body dominates the mind, when the appetites of the world become the things that we yearn for, the things that we hunger for, that's evidence that you don't have an inheritance in the kingdom, that you're not one of God's children, because the reverse is also true. When we have the Holy Spirit living in us, by definition, He is drawing us, He is pulling us toward the things that are meant to characterize us, the things that God is doing in our lives. So what he wants is to help people avoid self-deception, take an inventory and say, what captures my imagination? No person whose life pattern mentally and in practice is one of habitual sin can be a part of God's kingdom, because no such person can belong to God. He belongs to whatever it is that dominates his mind. If we recoil at the idea that God is going to punish sin someday, we should likewise recoil at the suggestion that we could ever be partners with sin. I used to do, work with youth occasionally, and teenagers, you know, we'd go to False Creek and we'd have those, bull sessions where you'd sit around with the high school guys and they'd want to ask questions. And inevitably when you're talking to a bunch of, you know, pubescent adolescents, the conversation goes in the direction of sex. And they'd say, well, so how far can you go and not be in trouble? I mean, this is not new to you, certainly, this idea of teenage boys being obsessed with such things. And I used to always tell them, it's the wrong question. If your question is, how deep into sin can I get before I've crossed a line and can't get back, then by definition, you're not following Jesus. See, the question is, how far away from sin can I get so that I can be fully effective in my pursuit of Jesus? Not, you know, is it right here on the line or is it toes over the line, or, you know, where exactly is the boundary? Well, wherever the boundary is, I want to be way back over here because Christ's likeness is in the opposite direction from sin. That's Paul's point in these passages. Verse 6, let no one deceive you with empty arguments. These are the Gnostics that he's not calling by name, but that's who he's talking about. Let no one deceive you with empty arguments, for God's wrath is coming on the disobedient because of these things. What are the Gnostics saying? You don't have to worry about that. God doesn't care about that. Your body's going to be destroyed in the end. You're going to get a new body. None of this matters. And Paul says, don't let those guys trick you. Don't listen. These are precisely the things that God will judge. Therefore, do not become their partners. You should run away when the opportunity for sin presents itself. All right? Reject the lifestyle of darkness, not because God said so or because he'll strike you dead, but because to walk in the opposite direction is tangible evidence that God is doing something remarkable, a transformation in your spirit and in your life. We come back to putting God on display by the way we live, as opposed to what he said in chapter 4, do not grieve God's spirit who is in us. All right? Walk in the lifestyle of light. Now this is where it gets really good. I mean, those verses are just introductory. This is the part I like. Look at verse 8. Now, verse 8 is one of my favorite verses. He says, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Now notice what he said there. He doesn't say you once walked in the darkness and now you walk in the light. He's not talking about your environment. He's not talking about your atmosphere. He says, you were darkness. You embodied the night. Your life was that way. There was a blackness in your soul. There was a nighttime in your heart. There was a midnight in your spirit. There was a dark gloom in your mind. You aren't just feeling your way through the darkness as though you were, you know, pure as the driven snow and you were just out there unable to find your way because it was so dark. I've been in caves before where you couldn't see your hand this close to your face. I mean, total darkness. But that's not what Paul's talking about. He's not talking about being in the darkness. He's talking about the darkness being in you. You were darkness. But now, he doesn't say you're in the light. He says, you are the light. Wow. For you were once darkness, but now you are the light. You are light in the Lord. Listen, he wants us to, this is a great verse in 704. We could spend the rest of our time right here on this verse, and I might just do that. Let's just camp here for a minute. For you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. After you wake up, Paul wants you to stay in the light. He wants you to live in the light permanently. You were darkness, Now, however, you are a defector from darkness. You have become light. Now, here's the thing. One of the confusing topics that is sort of making a reemergence in evangelical circles, it kind of drifted away, except in a couple of denominations, but it's beginning to reemerge, is this idea that we can lose our salvation. It is coming back, if you will, gaining popularity. My theory is it's gaining popularity because we have so many churches infected by so much sin that pastors and theologians are struggling to explain it. And so they're beginning to write off people and say, well, you know, they've rejected the faith and they've walked away from it. They've lost their salvation. I guess that's easier for them to tolerate than the idea that their church structure was so weak that they let unbelievers into the church family. I mean, that's the explanation. But this idea that you can lose your salvation is making a comeback. And Paul wants you to understand, when you were darkness, but now you are light, that is an irreversible transaction. You can't undo that. To become light in the Lord is to be in a whole new irreversible standing with Jesus. It's a word that speaks, because you're not in the light, but you are the light, it speaks of union with the one who is actually described as light. He's talking about existence in a new state which cannot be revoked. I love this. You were darkness, but now you're light. Listen, memorize that verse. This is one of the great verses to hold on to in the New Testament. Why? Because in my life, when the enemy comes after me, and just for me, even if I just have a passing thought, and there's an idea of something, and it just gets me for a minute, and I just have to kind of shake myself, the enemy is right there saying, see, even just that idea there for a second that you wanted to contemplate that, that's who you really are. That's who you are. That's inside of you. I've had that conversation with the devil lots of times because he's the accuser of the brothers. This verse is where I come back to and go, you know, that was me once. I was darkness, but now I'm light, and you can't go back. It's not a multiple choice question. I once was that, but now I'm not. I live in the light absolutely. Darkness and light indicates an absolute contrast. For Paul, darkness means confusion, evil, immorality, hatred, and distrust. Light, on the other hand, means majesty, glory, holiness, purity, and the revelation of God in his children. Verse 8 is Paul saying, the deeds of darkness that I've just talked about here, they are behind you. You have defected from darkness. You are an exile from darkness. That is not who you are. That's not where you live. Such things are no longer in harmony with your character, and you must not consider reverting to those practices. Real quickly, I don't often need to jump around when we have something as good as Ephesians, but let me read 1 John 3:9. 1 John 3:9, this is a great verse. Everyone who has been born of God does not sin because his seed remains in him. He is not able to sin because he has been born of God. This is how God's children and the devil's children are made evident. Now, that verse is often read with people going, so unless I'm perfect, I'm not a child of God because I sin all the time. And John says right here, everyone who has been born of God does not sin because he's not able to sin. Well, understand that when John is talking about this, he's talking, frankly, about the same thing Paul is talking about. He's talking about sin as a defining characteristic. When you didn't know Jesus, even if you were, quote, a good person, sin was the defining characteristic of your nature. You were a slave to sin. Now, total depravity is this idea. We misunderstand total depravity. We think it means I'm as bad as I could be. And so people go, well, I'm not as bad as the next guy. I mean, I'm a respectable person. Total depravity doesn't mean I'm as bad as I could possibly be. It means I'm as bad off as I could possibly be. I'm as completely separated from God as I could ever be. There's no way for me to find my way to God. But when God discovers you, when he draws you, when he adopts you, when he brings you into the family, when the blood of Christ is applied to you, well, all of a sudden, that's a transaction that is settled. God has bought you with a price, and now, while you may commit acts of sin, sin is no longer the defining characteristic of who you are. Think about it this way. I've used this illustration before over the years. You go out and you do yard work and you sweat and the weed eater blows the dirt and it gets on your legs and it gets, and you are covered in dirt from head to toe. I mean, you are filthy. What do? You go in the house. You probably undress on the patio. And then you go in the house. And you get in the shower and you stand under the water, and what happens? All washes away. Why? Because all of the dirt and the mud was external to you. It wasn't internal. It didn't define you. It was just on you. When a Christian commits sin, and we should not, we should avoid it. We should fight against it. We should withstand temptation. But when we do commit sin, it is like that dirt piled on us that makes us less than presentable to put Jesus on display. But when we come back to Jesus and he washes us clean, all of that washes away and we start fresh. Because for a follower of Jesus, for a believer, sin is external to us. But before we met Jesus, sin was internal. It defined our nature. It was who we were. So when John says, you're not able to sin, what he means is the core of who you are, you are a new creature, transformed by the Spirit of God. So you may have the actions of sin, but sin itself no longer is your master. In other words, don't tell me, Pastor, I just couldn't help myself. No. If you're a follower of Jesus and the Spirit of God lives in you, you now, for the first time in your life, have the legitimate ability to say no to sin. You do not have to give in to temptation because sin is not your master. We do make mistakes. We do commit sins. But it is not who we are. And the devil will say, see, you're a lousy Christian. Well, you know what? We think that often keeps us from coming back to God in confession because we think God doesn't want lousy Christians. When the fact of the matter is, the Father knows we're all lousy in one way or another. I mean, the father of the prodigal son, let's think about that Luke 15 story with the prodigal son. He leaves his father, he takes his inheritance, he goes off to live a wild life, loses all of his money, lives in dissipation, ends up a Jewish boy working in the pig pen. I mean, the bottom of degradation that a Jewish boy could ever end up, he's working in the pig pen, slopping the pigs. Now, this doesn't happen in the story, but let's use our sanctified imagination. Knowing what we know about that father who went out and looked every day and waited to see signs of his son coming home, if somebody had sent a message to that father and said, hey, listen, your boy, he's in a far country and he is working in a pig pen. You think the father would have said, nah, that's it, you know, pig pen, that's a bridge too far. I can't have that boy back. You know what that father would have done if he'd received that word? He'd have doubled down on his prayers for that boy. Why? Because the more desperate the boy's situation, the more energetically the father pursued him in prayer. The devil will tell you, you're a lousy Christian. I mean, look at what you did. You lost your temper and you yelled at your wife and you drive like a maniac and you talk to people in the other lanes in ways that Jesus would not approve of. You're just bad at this Christianity thing. What he wants us to do is to say, yeah, you know, I am bad at it. He wants us to stay away from the Father because we're embarrassed that we're not better Christians. The whole time the Father's going, you're not good at this? All the more reason to come home. Let me fill you with my Spirit. Let me wash you clean. Let me set you up on your feet so that you can start tomorrow a fresh new start. God is not up there going, man, I did all that for him and look what he gives me back. No, he's the father of the prodigal. He's doubling down. If you will just get out of the pig pen, I'm waiting here with open arms. I've got a robe to put on you. I've got a ring that shows you're my son. I've got a feast waiting for your return. We've got to quit buying the enemy's line that because we fall, God doesn't want us. When the fact of the matter is, when we fall, the answer is a beeline back to the Father. Why? Because we were darkness, but now we are light. It is who we are. The quality of the Christian life in the light means that our life can never be the same as it was before. You have been awakened, so now stay in the light. Now, what does life in the light look like? Well, look at where these verses are going to take us. Walk as children of light. Okay. Walk as children of light. What does that mean? For the fruit of the light results in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, discerning what is pleasing to the Lord. Four characteristics there. He says the life of light is first of all marked by goodness. That means every kind of practical benevolence in word or deed. In other words, it means being a good person in your relationship with other people. I read an article recently where a guy was talking about running out of gas on the side of the highway, and he lifted his hood and he stood there waiting for somebody to stop. And finally, on this road where there wasn't much traffic, finally a truck pulled over and the guy said, you got a problem? He goes, yeah, I'm out of gas. I got a gas can here, but I don't have any gas. I need to get up to the gas station a couple of miles up the road. And the guy said, I'll take you for $5. Now understand, this is the guy who was already going in that direction. I'll take you for $5. What? That's the world we live in. Goodness is an ever decreasing quality in our generation. And yet Paul says for people who are light, we don't have to think twice about it. It's who we are. We're the guy that helps without asking for reward. We're the guy that goes out of his way, is willing to be inconvenienced because somebody needs a helping hand, and we're that person. Life in the light is marked by goodness. It's marked by righteousness. This word righteousness means obvious, visible uprightness in all relations. In other words, how's your reputation with other people? I mean, if we just went door to door on your street and said, hey, I'm checking up on those people that live in that house right there. You know them? You've been around them? You've seen them? What's your reputation? What's the impression of your neighbors? Do they know you? They see you kicking and fussing and shouting at each other in the front yard? Do they hear things being smashed in the house because you got a temper? I mean, what do your neighbors think of you? This word righteousness is not really here. Paul's not really talking about righteousness in the sense of right standing with God. He's talking about right behavior toward other people. He's talking about having a reputation in our community that you know, we started by saying, if anybody says something about you, the family, the church family ought to be intimate enough to go, oh, that's not true. I know that guy. That's not him. That's not what he's like. But even with those out there who don't have that kind of church family intimacy, there still ought to be a reputation in the community where they go, well, I don't know that guy real well, but boy, he didn't strike me as that kind of person. You know, part of what caused the Christian church to explode across the Roman Empire in the middle of the emperor's persecution, whether it was Nero in the first century or Domitian or Diocletian or other emperors later on, Tertullian used to say that the blood of the martyrs was the seed of the church. What happened was Christians were arrested, they were falsely accused, and they were executed for these supposed crimes with their unbelieving neighbors going, wait, that guy lives on my street. I mean, he's the nicest guy in the world. He would help you with no expectation of getting anything in return. Why, that guy's not a criminal. As the Christians were executed for their beliefs, it was the unbelieving world that said, well, if that guy is unacceptable, I'd rather be like that guy. Nero is bat crap crazy. But that guy, I know that guy. He's a good man. And the church began to have an influx of people knowing that it was illegal to follow Jesus, but saying, I'm drawn to what I see in the lives of those people. That's righteousness. That's what he's talking about. A reputation in the community that makes Christianity attractive to people. They may not know doctrine. They may have never read the Bible. They may not know the story of Noah or Samson or David and Goliath. They may not know any of it, but they've been around you enough to know that there is something going on with this Christianity thing, and they're interested. I mentioned Sunday about inviting people to come to church with you on Easter. Listen, people aren't sitting around waiting to have some sort of theological debate with you about propitiation or transubstantiation or some other theological term that you don't understand. They're interested in your story because they know you and they think you're a pretty good person. And if you go to church, there must be something to it. And if you want them to go to church with you, chances are they'll say yes. That's righteousness. That's right standing in our relationships with other people. That's having a reputation that honors Christ. Well, then he says truth. Goodness, righteousness, and truth. This word truth means integrity, sincerity, straightforwardness in every relationship. In other words, does your word mean anything when you give it to people? You ever known a person who told you, yeah, I'll do that. I will do that for you. I will do that. I will be there on that day. And you walked away going, yeah, we'll see. I mean, never been trustworthy before. Why should they start now? You know how some people just have a reputation of saying things that they just don't ever live up to? Yeah, we'll be there. We will be there. And then you get a call, you know, like the night before. Oh, hey, man, something came up and I'm not going to be able to make it. Okay. And you're not surprised because you expected it. Because their word doesn't mean anything. What Paul says here is, this is a word, this word truth, in the sense of character quality, he's talking about having the currency of your word, so that when you put your yes on the table or you put your no on the table, people accept that at face value because your yes means yes and your no means no. You don't have to say, no, really, this time I mean it. Man, if you have to go there in conversation, you've already lost the battle. Now, I know, I haven't always been there for you, but this time I really mean it. You know what's better than that? Just living a life that people can take your word when you give it to them. I don't know if this guy's going to make it because you can't always trust him, but this guy said he'd be there and he's never let me down. That's what Paul means here. This is the lifestyle of the light. Goodness, righteousness and truth. But then there's one other thing here. He says, discerning what is pleasing to the Lord. I've called that carefulness. Discerning what is pleasing to the Lord. What he means here is the characteristic of a life in the light, a life of light, goodness, righteousness, and truth, but also a scrupulous concern in every situation to discover what it is that pleases the Lord. In other words, a light life is one that lets Jesus influence all of our decisions. Do we not find ourselves sometimes saying, well, that's a big decision. I better pray about it. What if we had this radical idea that every morning we prayed about the expectation of our schedule for that whole day? Lord, as far as I know, this is what I have on my plate for today. And I just want to walk through it with you because at each step I want to do what you want me to do. I want you to influence the way I walk through the day, the way I carry myself. I want to have a scrupulous concern in every situation that I please you. Does Jesus influence your desires? Does he affect your decisions? Does he govern your choices? Every area of life is to be determined by a prior commitment to the light. The whole question of the day is, what pleases God? Now, what was the characteristic, the bottom line characteristic of a life that is darkness? It's all about what pleases me. So it makes perfect sense that the bottom line question for a life in the light is, what pleases God? Let me tell you something. We lose the battle with temptation when we wait until we're in the heat of the battle to decide what we're going to do. If you've made some basic decisions in advance, temptation is a lot easier to face. You know, if that woman at work winks at you in a seductive way, and you have to go back to your desk and say, what am I going to do about this? Well, you've already lost the battle. Because the enemy is starting to play scenarios over in your mind. You're letting that bird nest in your hair. You're starting to cozy up to the idea, oh, I would never do that, but I'm just going to think about it for a while. But see, if you've made some decisions about living a life that is light, when that happens, you go, I'm not even going to think about that. I'm not interested in that. That is off limits for me. I'm a husband and one wife. I've got somebody over here that fills my eyesight. She's all I can see. See, you've already settled the temptation. You know, Billy Graham was the classic example. I love the story of him crossing a lobby in a hotel one time. And a woman sort of sidled up next to him and in a low voice made some suggestive comments about maybe joining him in his room. You got to love Billy Graham in so many ways. You know, most people's reaction would have been to try and avoid a scene. You know, I'm not interested. Billy Graham stepped back from her and raised his voice and he said, young woman, this is not acceptable and I will not accept what you have suggested to me, so you need to go on your way. And of course everybody's looking, and what's she doing? But what did he do? He slammed the door shut. He didn't slip away with just a crack still there that could possibly be capitalized on by the enemy. Why? Because he had decided in advance what a life of light looks like if that situation ever comes up. When you come over to our office buildings, you'll see that in all of our pastors' offices, in the doors, there are windows. They're not very big, but you can see into the office in these windows. When we bought those temporary buildings years ago, we sat down with the manufacturer and we kind of went through floor plans and what we were trying to do and everything. And I said, and I want windows in all the doors. And he said, oh, I'm sorry. We don't have any doors with windows. I said, well, put windows in the doors. I mean, how hard can it be? He goes, oh, no, we don't do that. We just have a standard door and we just don't have that available. I said, okay. Well, thank you for your time. We'll look somewhere else. Now this, even back then, this was a couple of $100,000 purchase. And I got up to walk out and he goes, whoa, wait a minute. You're telling me that because there's no windows in the doors that that's a deal breaker? I said, listen, what you need to understand is what we do here puts us in proximity in counseling situations all the time. And we're not going to put our pastors in danger of sitting behind closed doors where nothing can be seen, where they can either be tempted or they can be accused of something. If you can't put windows in the doors, then I'll have to go find a company that'll do that for me because, yeah, that's a deal breaker for me. You know what he said? I'll never forget what he said. I guess we can put windows in the doors. Yeah, I thought maybe you could. But see, that's an example of making a decision about what a light life looks like before you get into the battle with temptation. You settle some things up front. That's what he means here. Discerning what is pleasing to the Lord. Giving careful consideration to what it means to live this life. I don't want to short circuit the rest of these verses. Okay? We're going to stop right there. We'll wrap it up there because he's going to take us, the rest of this section all the way to verse 21. Okay. We'll do from here to verse 21 next week because, it's all tied. I thought we could get to verse 14, but we'll just pick up with verse 12 and move on from there. So read ahead. We've got one more section leading up to what then we'll spend 2 weeks in the next section of chapter 5 that talks about marriage. His detailed instructions for husbands and his detailed instructions for wives. And the reason I want to spend 2 weeks there is we've just been through a teaching series on Sundays on marriage. But Paul, he's talking about what a light life looks like. And he's not talking in big general terms. He is going to get just real, plainly practical of how to be married in a Christian marriage, what that looks like. And I don't want us to short circuit that conversation. So we'll spend a couple of weeks on those verses. So let's pray tonight. Father, thank you so much. Ephesians continues to just be such an encouragement, such a great study. Lord, I don't know if anybody in this room can sense it in their spirit, but I'm loving the study and I thank you for what you're showing me, what you're reminding me, the way you're teaching me. Lord, I pray that it's profitable, that we are recognizing what it means to be transformed by your presence in us and to live a life that is passionate in becoming like Jesus. Father, we want to work out our salvation with fear and trembling, understanding that that doesn't mean that we cower in your presence. It means that we are straining like an athlete to train in righteousness and be more completely like Christ day in and day out. Father, find that here, the hearts of your people devoted to pursuing, to chasing, to sharing shadows with Jesus. Father, let Ephesians be an effective tool in our spirits and by your spirit teaching us that we can become all that you have designed us and desired us to be. Father, thank you for the people of Evergreen. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.